Welcome to the first issue of what I hope will become a new Delimited podcast series. We're doing it as a bit of a trial. So today, it's Friday, and I'm quite tired, but we're going to push on ahead with this podcast. I'm sitting here with Sean Kay, who works in Australia's technology sector, and he's just started up a new blog, Startups Down Under. Hey, Sean, how's it going?
I'm well, thanks. How are you going?
Ah, pretty good, pretty good. So tell me a little bit about Startups Down Under, like why you started it sort of thing. Are you there?
Something interesting.
Oh, you're dropping out.
Oh, must be your recording stuff.
Yeah. Let's just try again. So tell me a little bit about Startups Down Under and why you started it.
Yeah. So basically, I decided it was something I was interested in for a long time. I've had some experience with running new companies in Australia, new technology companies, and some of the trials and tribulations that come with that here in this country. And some of it is also about how you compete internationally with a smaller business here in Australia. And so when the Atlassian issue came out, and there was this kind of debate around whether or not, you know, this was a good thing for Australia, for this company to be taking such large amounts of private equity from an overseas venture capitalist, it sort of triggered it for me that, well, if we want to have any kind of a startup industry in Australia, we're going to need that to happen. We're going to have to, for a while, become a net exporter of startups. And hopefully then, you know, that filters back into a class of super angels who then, you know, can seed new startup companies, which drive people to want to invest venture capital, and, you know, on and on the cycle goes. But I think we're at a point where we don't have the cycle. And that was obvious to me when we saw the Atlassian thing. So I decided, well, we'll start Startups Down Under and see what happens.
So it's a sort of a case where we've got some sort of centers of gravity for startups in Australia. We've got like Pollinizer, which is a startup consultancy. Sort of reminds me a little bit of Y Combinator in the US. We have a couple of centers of gravity for IT startups or web startups in Australia. I'm thinking particularly of Silicon Beach, the Google group set up by I can't quite remember his name. But also we have Pollinizer, which kind of reminds me a little bit of Y Combinator in a sense. Do you think we sort of need some more centers of gravity to sort of help bring people together in this community?
Well, I think there needs to be a slight realism check as well. I think this concept of let's start a Silicon Valley. Australia is a world leader in things like mining and things like construction. I mean, those are areas where Australia is, for all intents and purposes, the Silicon Valley of those industries. So Australia is already a world leader in something anyway. So I think, you know, that's something to say, well, you know, congratulations to those sectors. Now, can you be a Silicon Valley style startup creation incubator, whatever you want to call it? Well, where outside of Silicon Valley has that really been successful anywhere else? And lots of people have tried. You get a little bit in Boston around MIT, New York starting to take off. The only one I can really think of that's quite successful on a regular basis is Israel. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be around security technology and communications technology. But if you were, you know, you sort of think about it at a macro level, if you were a country surrounded by other countries that didn't really like you, and some were calling for your existence to be wiped out, you'd become very good at security and you become very good at communicating. And so I think, you know, without being flippant about it, I think Israel has a culture of export. And so, you know, they're good for it. But nobody else has really competed with Silicon Valley. So I think it's about setting goals and having some realism.
Maybe we need to start more startups who are focused on the mining sector and on Bondi Beach, maybe.
Yeah, that's right, on surfing technology. No, look, I think the construction industry is definitely one where, I mean, from my own personal experience, I've seen a lot of startup technology there. Probably one of the best known ones in the country now is Aconex, who do project collaboration software. They got $50 odd million of investment funding back in 2008, just right around the time the GFC started. They pulled in about $50-odd million of private equity from a U.S. Private equity firm. So, and you know, they're growing internationally now at a rate of knots. You know, that was a company who started out in Australia in sort of 99-2000, spent, you know, a number of years getting their technology together in Australia, building some customers. And then as and when they won business overseas, they would reinvest their proceeds from those wins into new offices in those countries. And they sort of grew organically as and when they continued to win. I think, you know, they're a classic example. If you were to look at a venture backed business in Australia of what you've got to do to be successful, you know, Aconex is a pretty good one to look at, as is obviously Atlassian. They're just, you know, and SpringSource and those kind of guys are just ridiculously successful. But Aconex is probably a closer model to what the Australian market needs to generate, and that's, you know, use the local market as a small proving ground, which it is. 21 million people. It's not a huge market, right? And then, you know, take that technology and move it overseas. And I think Aconex is in the construction. They just won a contract for their project collaboration software in mining, a mining site in Canada, I think, a couple of days ago. So you know, they're venturing out into domains of knowledge that Australians are good at.
We also have a couple of other examples come to mind. We also have Mincom, which, as far I think I remember, is based out of Queensland, and they basically provide I think it's enterprise resource software to you know, to mining companies. And obviously, I think they got their start in Australia, and I think that they end up being acquired by a private equity firm, and now they have quite substantial global operations. Another example would be we have a couple of other software firms, Technology One, which is also based in Queensland, and Objective, and both of them kind of really have a speciality in local government, which we have quite a lot of in Australia. And just again, not in another sector, you know, something that we do well in Australia, we have a lot of local government, and taking that overseas. So I like what you're saying about the idea of using our strengths rather than trying to become something we're not.
Well, no, I think if I think it's an unrealistic goal to assume that the next Facebook or Twitter will come out of Australia. You know, there's only one or two of those ever, and just sheer volume of numbers suggests that that's just probably very unlikely to happen here, and that's okay. It is what it is, right? But there's certainly a case that, you know, Web 2.0 startups can happen here in Australia, be very very successful with domain-level knowledge and export that globally to the world. I mean, Australian contracting, construction process, those are kind of things that that are taking the world over. I mean, you look at you look at the Games of London in 2012. All of the, you know, Westfield are a major player. Lendlease are a major player. These are Australian companies with Australian process building and managing and implementing major facilities management and construction management processes. So, you know, the other, you know, there's we have good skills in that. So software around that space seems to me to be something that would be a good fit.
Do you think that there's, because over the years that I've been a technology journalist, I've seen a lot of things like, you know, governments trying to set up technology parks, and we've got a bit of that in Sydney with, you know, what's happening at Macquarie, and also in, you know, the technology park down in Redfern. Do you think these sort of spaces have, like, are they useful at providing, like, you know, a space for startups, or are they kind of like just a bit of, something that will work on paper but won't work in practice?
I think there's an opportunity for it to work. I just think it's not in the right order. It assumes that a startup has some level of working capital to get there. And I think that's the problem in Australia. If you look at the early stage venture capital limited partnership, I wrote about this like last week sometime. You know, that actually is a really interesting structure to promote early stage venture capital. It you know, it's tax-free returns, all kinds of huge wins for people who invest, and also for fund managers, you know, getting things like tax-free carry and tax-free interest on carry. You know, those are kind of those are really nice baubles. I mean, those are things they're fighting for. You know, well, fighting for and against, depending on who you read in the U.S. So, you know, that is a really good program. I think the problem we have is that pre-venture capital, we don't have an angel market. And so you have a really good idea and you need to go do a friends and family type round. You need to try and figure out, how to get, you know, between zero and $400,000 of capital to get you off the ground. And get you some kind of a proof of concept project, and that doesn't exist in Australia. I mean, you're really at that point, sadly, begging to your family and friends. I think that's where an Atlassian comes in. I think if there are more of those kind of companies where, you know, those guys do well, some of the senior staff do well. They're not all going to pick up and move to the U.S. Australia is a wonderful place to live. I mean, as somebody who doesn't come here, I'm a migrant, right? I'm here because I want to be here. And so it's a really great place to live. So if you can kind of take some of the money you've successfully recovered out of starting up a win like that and then reinvest that money into a new startup here in Australia, those guys will do it. And there's evidence of that. I mean, you look at the Dave McClures, you look at Jason Calacanis, you look at Chris Dixon, you know, these guys are all entrepreneurs who've had a win, who still love being entrepreneurs, and they want to invest in new startups, and they tend to want to, they don't have, you know, huge venture funds, so they tend to invest in smaller companies where their skill set and knowledge can actually make a real difference. They, you know, we don't have that here, and we need it.
Well, we've seen some small examples of that. I mean, we've got I know that like a couple of weeks ago, Dominic Carosa, who obviously has been involved in a lot of things online in Australia, he's got this Future Capital Development Fund, which you know, they have Simon Baker from realestate.com.au. They have I was just trying to remember who else they've got. They've got a few other people who've been involved in this, been involved in the dot-com sector in Australia, and they've sort of put a few investments out there. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, they invested in cheaphotels.com.au, which I think is, you know, an alternative to whatif.com sort of thing. So there is some of this sort of stuff going on, I guess. And you see other people, even Malcolm Turnbull. The Turnbulls got involved in Web Central after their AusEmail, exit. And you do see this sort of thing sporadically happening. But it certainly doesn't have the formality around it, I guess, that you'd see in Silicon Valley. You don't see a lot of, you know, formal opportunities for startups to get involved with angels, and it tends to be more through friendship networks or, you know, people get introduced to other people through certain things. But I like what's happening at the moment with Pollinizer, because it seems like that's become like a bit of a place where they have those connections, and if you get involved in them as a startup, then they can sort of help you with those connections. So we're starting to see some of that, but I think it will take a new generation. I think there's we need to have some more of the young people are coming up and making some wins as well. So, because we've had that older generation of startups, we had things like whatif.com and realestate.com.au, and we had a couple of big wins in the last couple of years, things like Atlassian and so on. But yeah, it seems like most of the people who have had those wins are in the older generation now. So,
well, I think there's a couple of points there. Is what Dominic's doing. I saw Dominic speak several months back at a venture capital raising event, and you know, what he's doing is interesting. What Y Combinator are doing is interesting. Mick is a great proponent for the startup businesses here in Australia, and we need more people like that. I think, you know, that's one of the inspirations why I'm at all interested is people like that. They, you know, you get passionate about seeing people be successful from the ground up. So hats off to them. I think the problem is they have no competition. So they're the only game in town. And that's not, you know, to say that's a bad thing, but, you know, entrepreneurs need some options as well. And that's not Mick's fault and it's not Dom's fault. It's just the market is what it is. If you had, you know, your Y Combinator also, you know, competes with your Techstars, which competes with your, you know, previously with your TechCrunch 50, which competes with your launch conferences, all these kind of things, right? If there was a number of ways where startups could get off the ground, get some traction, get some funding, and get through the early stages of, you know, taking the product from the idea through to, the proof of concept, through to early customer stage acquisition. If we could get them to that point where they actually have real customers and real revenue, then I think what happens at that point is the investment money will start loosening up because they're real businesses then. And, unfortunately, you know, there's just not enough Mix and there's not enough Doms with money who are willing to do that. I think there's a couple other structural problems. I mean, one of the reasons, or one of the things I don't want to do with Startups Down Under is whinge about government policy, right? Because I don't think it gets you anywhere. I think sitting around lobbying the government to change the rules is just stupid. I think you're wasting your time. I think one of the problems that said is that there's a huge disincentive, for staff to take options in this country. And so that whole lean startup ramen noodle kind of concept is really difficult here. You know, when you have a really good developer in Sydney or Melbourne or wherever, and they can go work for $100,000 a year at a bank, and you're saying, well, come work for me at my startup making, you know, fuzzy bubbles or whatever you want to call it. And you know, fuzzybubbles.com is paying, you know, $45,000, but you're going to get 100,000 options. Well, you know, you can't eat 100,000 options, but that, you know, $100,000 a year check from a bank to do contract level programming, that's going to help my family buy a car and all that stuff. And the other thing is the one who does take the options just gets slugged with capital gains tax, gets slugged with everything. It just doesn't. It's just not geared towards the startup sector. And then that comes back to, well, is there anything the government can do about it? Because if you started screwing around with options and capital gains tax and all that stuff, what you'd have is the banks and the large, you know, large publicly listed businesses would start paying all their executives in options who then not pay tax on those options. So, I mean, I'm realistic. I understand that options and things are difficult. I just think the government needs to do some work maybe to carve out a niche for small business to be able to give equity to staff. And you'd think, I mean, maybe I'm being idealistic, but you'd think that would be a very a concept that labor would be very interested in, that – you know, staff getting an equity position in the company they work for, and finding a way to make that a profitable thing for staff to take up. I think right now what happens with options is they're a reward rather than an incentive.
Definitely when I was starting my company, I didn't really think about that. I mean, I've got a couple of employees now, but the way that, you know, whenever I've worked for other people, I haven't really seen, you know, working for a company as being an investment in that company. And actually, when I have received options in companies that I've worked for before, I've kind of been like, well, that's a real surprise. Like, I never really expected that. And I think you're right. In Australia, there isn't really that. We don't really have a culture of, you know, you're not just working for a company, but you could, you know, have options in that company, which gives you like a real long-term incentive to really build it. I think that could definitely be something which would help help the startup sector if we start thinking a bit more that way.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, I think that's where you'll drive businesses to liquidity events as well. I'm a big believer in the liquidity event. I think that any, you know, I'm sort of an economic rationalist about this. If you own a business, the business is your asset. And if you're a business person, then you should put a value on that business that's the best for you and your shareholders. And if somebody comes along and offers you something at, near, or in excess of that number, then the realistic thing to do is to say, can I get more? Is this worth more? And then maybe, you know, then take it and cash out. And if we had these liquidity events happening regularly and staff were had options and shares and they had time to vest, then you'd have more and more people in the sector with some loose change. And look at, you look at Foursquare. I mean, that's a classic example where the guy created Dodgeball. He sold it to Google. Google basically, shot it in the head. He made enough money that he could comfortably start, Dennis Crawley, I think his name is. He could comfortably start Foursquare. Didn't need a whole lot of venture capital, to start with. And now, they're on top of the world. I think that's where these little liquidity events can really drive innovation and drive a startup culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I guess it's the dream of most startups to achieve that liquidity event, but it's a long, hard road on the way.
Well, I think the difficulty with liquidity events in Australia is that there's not a buying market. Mm-hmm. And I think it's how you have to position your company. I think if you look at an Atlassian, they never once, and Mike or somebody might come on and disprove me, but they never once said, well, we're limited to Australia. We're going to do something that completely limits us to Australia. Yourself, on the other hand, as an entrepreneur, you're tailoring your deliverable exclusively to Australia. And so therefore, you're really cutting out the number of people who potentially will acquire you. And that's okay. That's a conscious choice, right?
Well, it's not so much that I'm cutting out people who could acquire me. I mean, if I think about the long term, I mean, you could, if I think about Delimiter, in the long term, you could see a situation where, an international company would want to expand into Australia, and so acquire local brands. And we've seen that, with Fairfax in going into New Zealand, picking up, things like Trade Me in New Zealand, So for that sort of side of things, I more took an editorial slant because I saw an opportunity in the local market. But I understand what you're saying. There's certainly a lot more to be said for if you want to grow large, focus on something that will be globally in demand. That's clearly what Atlassian's done. They've built something which nobody else really has globally, and they're sort of taking that globally. It's an interesting dichotomy. I mean, it's even if you go back and look at what I think was Foursquare and GoWallah. I think one of those I remember they sort of looked at the local. They built local scale first. I think they launched in one city. It might have been Boston or something like that.
Yeah, I think it was GoWallah.
Yeah, GoWallah. They launched in I think it was Boston. I'm not quite sure. And they sort of rolled out that model around the US after they had launched in Boston. So it's something you've got to think about when you're starting a company. What area are you going to focus on?
Yeah, well, I think you raise an interesting point, which comes back to the Australian startup sector again, is Groupon is probably one for me that I find interesting to look at. Groupon, can start in San Francisco, but they have to expand or can start in Chicago or wherever, right? And it can be really good at the local market, but to become a big enough player, and to hit the high notes and to be the grand slam of exits and all that sort of stuff, you really need to expand quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So, the Groupons of the world in the United States have, literally hundreds of markets to expand into of reasonable size. Mm-hmm. Whereas, in Australia, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth, you start then you're in Adelaide and suddenly you're down into the sub 500,000 people market, for products and services, and you know, there's just not enough. The base is not high enough. That said, if you could do Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth correctly, there's then nothing stopping you from doing well in San Francisco, Dallas, Fort Worth, Chicago, Vancouver, Toronto, New York City. You know, I mean, we do have big, large international cities in this country. And if you are solving a problem, and you're doing it successfully, and we're talking obviously commercial internet, you know, not business or enterprise, but you know, that commercial style, business to consumer internet. If you can solve that problem here in Australia, there's nothing that prevents you technically from taking that idea, unless it's so localized, you know, and maybe that's a model people need to look at is, well, I have a good idea. I'll test it in Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane. And then my next stop maybe isn't Perth. Maybe it's Atlanta, Georgia. I don't know, right?
Well, I think this ties into something I've been thinking a lot about recently, which is the idea that in Australia we had this really strange mentality about the products and services that we buy. And the first thing we tend to think of in Australia when we're buying a product or service, and this really applies to the web sector at the moment, is we don't want to be left out. So the number one thing which Australians hate, you know, in terms of technology especially, is we want to have the same technology, the same access to everything that they have in the US, that they have in the UK, that they have in Japan, and all that sort of stuff. And this really ties into the sense of entitlement that people feel at the moment about the national broadband network and things like that. So if I take the example of, you know, like a web service, say if an Australian company launched a product like Gmail, which is, you know, just a great, you know, web-based email product, it would really have to offer Australians something quite significant, even if it was exactly the same product, for Australians to use it, as compared to, you know, instead of Gmail, because we really, as a nation, we feel like we want to use the same stuff which everybody has access to globally. I think that the reason for that is because we're on the sidelines of the globe geographically. We really feel like we get left out sometimes. We get, you know, all technology launches late in Australia, sort of thing. But I think if you look at something like Groupon, that brings a challenge, because for Australians, would Australians start to use a local service like Groupon that was focused on certain cities in Australia? Or would they prefer to use a similar service, you know, which would also focus on cities in Australia, but was also, you know, had been popularized overseas? Probably they would want to use the service which is popularized overseas first. So I've seen that, for example, with Delimiter, in the way people relate to Delimiter, and people primarily on the internet, they want to read services like Mashable and TechCrunch and so on, because they're the global standard for news in this sector. But then they sort of feel like it's almost like a guilty pleasure reading something local, I guess, or using a local service. You know, like they slowly find themselves being seduced by it. But it's this really weak sense of nationalism that I think will mediate against those really local services launching in Australia.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. One is maybe I have the beauty of I'm not from here, so I have a different perspective on it. My view is that's the what you've described is a form of what people almost used to call American imperialism, right? Mm-hmm. If it's the best in the U.S., it's got to be the best. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to be buying second best. Nobody does. Nobody wants to spend money on the second best. And that goes through in all parts of life. Like, there's I remember at university doing political science, and a professor once said to me, there's probably 25% of the population who don't know how they're going to vote until one day out from the election when they see who's going to win. Mm. And then they vote for the winner because nobody wants to pick the loser.
Mm, that's right.
And so there's a huge sentiment in just human nature where, you know, you've got a company like Spreets, which is, I think, part of the Pollinizer group in some way, shape, or form. I'm not entirely sure, but Spreets is kind of like a Groupon, for Australia. Now, without you know, hurting mixed businesses too much, it would be fascinating to see what would happen if Groupon opened up in Australia.
Exactly.
You know, would they, would Spreets have a natural, competitive advantage by being on the ground, being local, being here first, you know, first mover advantage, all those kind of wonderful things we like to talk about, or would just the sheer gravitas of the Groupon brand suddenly overwhelm them and people say, well, I want to be part of Groupon. So I think that's something that's there. I think the other thing that we need to come to think of a little bit, and it's how I, you know, maybe it's my own personal view, but I tend to think of Australia as part of the English speaking world. And there's a bit of tyranny of distance and all that stuff, but New Zealand and Australia and the UK and Canada and the United States are the English speaking world. And if you have a business or a service that appeals to Australians, culturally, systemically, even legally in most cases and structurally, it's not a hard leap to take that to those other English speaking countries. I mean, with my experience with Insight, I mean, we did look at, you know, Asia, as did, you know, Aconex. Asia is hard. And Asia is hard because every country has its own set of languages and they have their own cultural imperatives. And, while Australians, you know, and this is my experience with Australians all over the world, are actually pretty culturally sensitive. And that's kind of, you know, something that Australians can go to a place and fit in. And so, you know, while that's a strength, it's still easier to fit in the UK, in Canada, the United States, or New Zealand, because culturally it's not a huge shift. And so even things like systems and software and everything that we use, there are going to be just inherent similarities in all those markets. So when I talk a lot about, well, you know, go to San Francisco or go to Chicago next after you conquer the big cities here in Australia, it's not because I'm thinking Asia's not worth going to. I just think Asia's hard. You know, if you're successful in China, I'm going to tell you within 15 minutes, somebody's going to have a clone of what you're doing and selling it for a fraction of the price.
Yeah, exactly.
That's just what they do. And that's okay. That's their market, right? They can set the rules however they like. But I think, entrepreneurs who are doing web startup companies in Australia need to think globally. The other problem I've experienced sort of go on a little bit, but the other problem I've experienced in my own career with dealing with startups and things like the construction and mining sector, for example, is these guys, you know, entrepreneurs in this country seem to want to dive right in and take on the 10,000 pound gorilla.
Yep.
You don't dive into a marketplace and go after the biggest, ugliest, you know, bear in the zoo. Like, it would be wonderful if, you know, you could go out and get BHP as your first customer. That'd be lovely. But the chances are that if you're a small startup, if you get in the door at BHP and they listen to you and they consider you and they configure that they can use your product and they can buy your software, the cost of supporting that organization will almost certainly destroy your company. I have experience with it. I can tell you firsthand, those companies are hard. They are not easy to deal with. BHPs, Rios, in the construction side, the Leighton companies, they're big companies. They have their own way of doing things. And if you're a small, dynamic 2, 3, 4, 10-man shop, you know, these are organizations with hundreds of technology people who have agendas, who have their own motivations, and, you know, it can be very difficult to deal with. Now, if you're in the construction sector, there are thousands of small 1- and 2-man consultancies. There's architects all over the place. Go be successful with those guys. Like, you know, go get 10, 15 small little customers under, you know, on your books. Go listen to their needs, adapt your product to suit their requirement. And by that stage, once you've kicked those tires, you're going to be in a lot better shape to start moving up the food chain. But I do think, from what I've seen here in Australia, entrepreneurs have just this tendency to want to dive in the deep end. And I think take some swimming lessons first.
Well, it's certainly something I've seen in my own business. I mean, like probably over the last 6 months since I launched Illumina, I've probably all up had, I guess, eight or nine customers. And I've probably talked to, I guess, about, I don't know, maybe another half dozen or so customers. And usually what I've found in my own business is that it's easiest for a small company like ours to deal with other small companies. And the reason for that is that they can afford to be more nimble. They can bring things to the table that the bigger companies just, you know, they're not able to. You're usually dealing with somebody who is in charge of their own business and is able to make decisions quickly. Whereas with the dealing with big companies, even something like the legal costs of dealing with a large company can be terminal for a startup. Just because, I mean, how as a startup with limited capital, you can't deal equally with a large company. You're always going to be at a disadvantage in that sort of situation.
Well, the problem you have is in some cases as well is, while you may have something they want, your track record and your size works against you. You become a risk. So if a small company manages to get its software in the door at BHP and said company is having financial difficulties and BHP use it to, I don't know, manage contract miners in West Australia or something like that, you become a risk for them. And that's when they turn the screws on you. When you pop up on a risk committee report, you get a lot of attention. When the head of risk management, for BHP knows your company exists, you're not in good shape. So you really want to make sure that when you go in to start slaying the beast, that you're not, you don't have to be huge or anything, but you do have something behind you. So, cause otherwise they're just going to put contractual terms and things in front of you. And I know I've done it myself where we've seen products from small companies where we've said, well, look, I want your software in escrow. Not only do I want your software in escrow, I want these triggers on it. And in the event that the escrow gets triggered, we get a perpetual license to the source code. And that's not being taking advantage of a small company or being hostile or whatever. It's just that when we're dealing with Microsoft or IBM, they're not going to go broke. Right?
That's right. Yeah.
They're not going out of business anytime soon. And so things like escrow and that, it's not as important, right? But with smaller businesses, it's a big issue. So, one of the pieces of counsel I always try and give people who talk to me about, well, can you get me an in with so and so, is if you go in to see this person and you don't have 15 reasonable customers that they can call, they're not gonna listen. And if they do listen and they do see something they like, it's gonna cost you a lot of money. And I think there's a better way to build a business. And that sort of leads, I guess, to the next point is in Australia with the startup community in particular is counsel and advice and mentoring. It's sorely lacking. The number of people I meet, who are, guys starting businesses and things who have no idea about trademarks, intellectual property law is a fascinating one, right? I personally don't believe in software patents. I think they're an abhorration, but I do think trademarks are important and understanding copyright is important. Because that is your intellectual property. And the number of people who start businesses with a complete disregard for that kind of stuff and it eventually costs them, is really quite high. And I think, if we had people who were willing to spend, a couple hours a week talking to startups and saying, okay, look, here's a, here's a solicitor I know. They're very good in IP law. Go see them. It's going to cost you X, but you really need to do that, or an accountant or whatever. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff where with Startups Down Under, I'm sort of, I guess I'm making myself available in that regard. I do know, you know, I know accountants, I know lawyers, I know people who can help you, with those kind of issues. And, you know, these people don't work for free. Don't get me wrong, but, it's a case of where, well, if you don't know anybody in that sector, having somebody introduce you is, excuse me, generally the best way to get an in.
It's definitely something. I mean, you know, when I started Delimiter at the start of this year, there's so many things that I wish I'd known previously. Like, you know, things about you know, the legal side of things, the you know, the company side of things in terms of how you deal with the tax office and how you deal with the Australian Securities and Investments Commission and all that sort of stuff, and even just, you know, setting up systems for finance, for customer relationship management. So I myself, you know, I've done, you know, courses in small business. I understand, you know, what the difference is between a cash flow statement and a profit and loss statement. I've worked at the Financial Review. I have like quite a degree of knowledge about this, but when you start to get into it in practice, I mean, there's so many things. I think having that that center of knowledge where you can, you know, really go to people and ask them for advice, I think is really critical for startups. And I especially think talking to other startups, because they've been through this, exactly the same sort of things. I mean, some of the critical issues for us have been that, you know, we've had these little issues, we've had issues, and other people have said, well, you know, that's simple, you just go to this person, talk to them about this. But if they hadn't said that, you might spend a week, you know, mucking around trying to find, you know, the right person in the right place, and you know, all it takes is somebody just to point you in the right direction.
Well, I think interestingly enough, in the US, you know, they have this seed stage angel group that's growing rapidly, and some venture capitalists and things. And one of the things that, you know, VCs have become very free with is information. And one of the things that I never really was a very big believer in, but I've changed my tune in probably the last couple of years, is that, you know, small companies, even small privately held companies, really do need advisory boards. You know, because the number of people who I've met who are amazing software developers with wonderful ideas who don't know the difference between cash flow and a balance sheet is staggering. And if you don't know, if you can't do a cash flow projection, it's virtually impossible to get money from anyone, because nobody's going to give you a dollar if you don't know what you're going to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I've seen other companies that I've dealt with, small companies in the past, you know, 10, 12 years, who've had a modicum of success, but have had so much technical prowess and so little management nous that they mismanage their success and end up failing despite success. So I think that's where, if you're a small company, and you're, you know, and I'm a technical person by nature, you know, development networks and those kind of things. So I can relate to those kind of guys. But I think, you know, if I were starting a company and I knew my strength was technology, and I didn't have a co-founder or whatever who was strong on the sales, marketing and management side, I would seriously look at finding a mentor, finding somebody with some business background behind them. And even if you have to flick them 2-5% of the company and say, please sit on my board and once a month help me with, you know, looking at my financials and looking at my business plan and being there to take a phone call to talk strategy about, that's a worthwhile investment. Because, you know, you could have 100% of nothing very quickly. You know, I'd rather own 95% of something well managed than 100% of something that's managed piss poorly.
Yeah, definitely. I take your point. Like, even with Delimiter, like, I find with us that, you know, if you, it's important to look at the background of each of the founders. So my background is in editorial. Obviously, when running the company, I'm going to focus more on editorial. But, you know, so as someone with that background, and I guess I'd broadly term that as someone with a background in operations. You know, you've got a background in the operations of the company. You need to focus on the sales and the administration side of it just as heavily. Otherwise, the company is going to end up unbalanced in one direction.
Oh, I think it's human nature. We have a tendency to skew towards what we're good at. We focus our attention and our time on things we're good at. I hate certain things, you know, so therefore I do as little as I can to get those done. But when it comes to running your business, if you're a technology person, it's probably something I can't stress enough. You don't have the luxury of ignoring the business side. I think this concept of if I build a great product, people will find me and they'll use it, and the money will just come. It's a form of madness. I'm a big fan of the 37 Signals guys, right? And that's something that they are kind of proponents of, that, you know, focus on delivering a really great product and the sales will take care of itself. Well, yeah, the sales will take care of yourself if David Hanemeyer Hansen is writing your software, because he gets to speak at RubyConf and he's in magazines, and David Fried is writing for Inc. magazine, and you know, like, sales take care of themselves, sure, but if you're a small little nobody, you don't have the luxury of just building a great product and not pushing it or understanding how the business works and forgetting about, you know, letting revenue take care of itself. You gotta get out there and hustle. And I think the other one, you know, of interest to me is the number, and this is just from, you know, experience in the last few years, is the number of people who are technologists who start companies and say, well, I'm the CEO or I'm the managing director. And then you say to them, well, how much time do you spend with your customers? Oh, well, no, I'm the lead developer. Well, yes. You've just told me your job description. You're the lead developer. You're the CTO. You're whatever you want to be. You're not the managing director. The managing director is about setting strategy and finding out what customers want and adjusting the business accordingly, right? And I think it's just that education process that, you know, needs to happen. And it's not, you know, people aren't stupid, but I would say that the country doesn't have a culture of software startups. So a lot of ideas are being learned on the fly. And so I think, you know, we need to have people dipping in and offering advice and mentoring and helping wherever possible.
Well, with that, I think we've been going for quite a while. Maybe it's time to wrap it up. What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I think the last thing I'd like to talk about is we need to kind of figure out a way in this country, and I'm not sure how we do it. And it's definitely a goal of mine I have two goals, I think, for Startups Down Under that I'd like to meet in the next sort of 12 months. One is skills. I think, you know, we need to start finding the people out there who have great skills, great technology capabilities, and getting those people attached to the startups who need those skills. So, you know, we need to start figuring out a way to transfer that. The second thing is, I think we need a conference like a TechCrunch 50 or what Calacanis is doing with the launch conference. I think we need to be able in this country once a year, and I know there's one that I think Ant Hill or somebody put on in August, but I think it needs to be driven by the industry for itself. And it's definitely one of the things I think is a critical thing we've got to get together, is find these new companies with great ideas, good technology, and find a way to get people who are willing to invest in ideas and in concepts and in software, get them there and let these companies pitch to them and open up the door, you know, for people to put their capital into startups and I guess just create that environment for that to happen. So that would be something I'd like to see in the next 12 months is I'd like to see sort of Australian version of the launch conference get off the ground. And if, you know, it's something I'm willing to work on personally. So if there's anyone else out there who's interested in participating, you know, I'm pretty visible. I'm easy to get a hold of. I know you said yourself that's something you'd like to be involved in as well. So.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like, because I feel like there's one thing that if I say the one thing that I enjoy more than anything else, and I'm fortunate enough as a journalist to be able to do this, is I love talking to people who are passionate about things. And what you see in the startup sector, and particularly in Australia, because we are a bit isolated, is people who start startups in IT are really, really passionate people. And so I think the great thing about conferences around this sort of thing is you get so many ideas and connections come out of them that it's quite hard to you know quantify exactly what it is, but you just know that it's been tremendously influential. So yeah, Delimiter will definitely get behind anything like this. I just wish we could cover more of what's happening. As a startup ourselves, we have limited resources, but we always try and go the extra mile for startups because you know they will eventually grow to be something big and like supporting the Australian industry. So, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, that's kind of in closing, I think that's the call to action to people out there who are listening. If you're running a startup in Australia, you know, get in touch, go to Startups Down Under, send me a message, you know, send Renee an email. You know, you're responsible for lifting your own visibility. Like, I'm not going to go out and on my free time and find you. But if you send me an email and say, hey, this is what my company's doing, I'm always happy to talk to entrepreneurs. I get a whole bunch out of it. I just find it great fun. And you know, and maybe I might have some advice that'll help, or you can ignore me or whatever. But the idea of writing about, you know, exciting new startup on Startups Down Under and talking about, you know, their ambitions and their goals and their aspirations and their needs. It's kind of something I'm happy to do in my spare time and help promote those people. So yeah, definitely that's the call to action. The takeaway from this is, you know, if you're a small business, and you're a startup company, particularly in the software space, I mean, that's my personal interest. Then yeah, get in touch and, I'm happy to try and help promote you and help you build your business as much as, you know, time allows.
Well, Sean Kay, thanks for speaking with us. Sean's new site is startupsdownunder.com. He's already got a bunch of posts on it, so go and check it out. It's really worth it. We'll keep in touch about you know the conference that you're interested in planning, and we'll keep trying to grow the IT startup sector in Australia. So thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you later.